You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of The World of the Senses and the World of the Spirit, a cycle of lectures given in Hanover from the 27th of December 1911 to the 1st of January 1912. This is Lecture 4, given on December 30th, 1911. It is relatively difficult for us to gain an idea of what we normally call matter. In order to clarify spiritually the nature of matter, of substance, the main question to ask is, what is the most striking characteristic of the stuff we ordinarily call matter? Well, if we proceed without prejudice, we shall find its most striking characteristic to be that it fills up space, it spreads out into space. If we have an experience in our soul, for example, a feeling or a thought or even an impulse of will, it would never occur to us to regard these as taking up space. We can all surely see what nonsense it would be to say that one thought or another, for instance, the idea of a hero, is 5 square meters larger than the idea of an ordinary human being. If we think this through, we will soon notice that the concept of filling up space or spreading out in space cannot be applied to a state of our soul or the processes of our soul. Another characteristic of matter, though, would be to say that it is supposed to have weight. However, this attribute of weight is not so simple, as we shall see as these lectures proceed. If we approach the world solely by looking at it, no amount of looking or contemplating will show us anything to do with weight. All we are aware of is the filling out of space, the spreading out into space. We also know that this spreading out is usually measured by the 3 dimensions which we apply to space, the dimensions of height, width, and depth. It is a general and ordinary truth to say that things extend in space in accordance with the 3 dimensions. So we would have to recognize that this spreading out in space is the most striking characteristic of matter. When we now consider what has just been said, namely that we cannot speak about filling up space with regard to what we have in our soul, we shall have to agree that there is more to it than merely the way in which matter, substance, fills up space, since there is this further observation, which can also legitimately be made on the physical plane, namely, that there are other processes or conditions which do not spread out in space, namely the processes or conditions of soul. If we look at experiences of soul in the same unprejudiced way as we first looked at experiences of substance, we will soon discover another characteristic of these soul experiences, without which they cannot come about. And that is that they proceed in time. Even though we cannot say that a feeling or an impulse of will is 5 meters in length or 5 square meters in size, we have to agree that what we feel and think, in so far as these are experiences of soul, does run its course in time, and that there is no specific time required for these experiences, since one is earlier, another later. In short, what we experience in our soul is subject to time. The situation is that in the reality of everything around us and everything we ourselves are, space and time relationships are mingled together. In the external world, in particular, things are spread out in space while also happening one after the other in time. They require a certain amount of time. Before we begin our examination of the spiritual truths, we have to ask, what is the relationship of space with time? Here, in an anthroposophical cycle of lectures, we are touching, quite innocently, upon a question which has always been one of the great questions of philosophy, and about which countless thinkers have racked their brains, the relationship of space with time. With regard to this relationship between time and space, which, as I just said, we are approaching quite innocently, it may not be easy for you to follow the thoughts in question, since many of you are not trained philosophers. But if you make the effort to pursue such ideas, you will see how infinitely fruitful they are, and how, especially if you work on them in your meditation, you will be able to take them further. It is a good idea to begin with the time which you experience in your own soul. Ask yourselves how you experience time in your own inner being, or let me be more precise by suggesting that you do not look at the time which you can tell by looking at a clock. That, of course, amounts merely to comparing your inner life with external events. Refrain entirely from seeing what the time is by looking at a clock or other external happenings. Consider only how you might ask your soul, in what way is the relationship of time expressed in my own soul? Whatever the depth of your thinking, and however thorough your consideration of the question might be, you will discover only one thing which is relevant to time, and this is that you are now able to grasp a thought which you have permitted to arise in you on the basis of an external observation. You look at something, or you listen to something, and then a thought or a conception arises in your soul. And when you question more precisely the relationship you yourself have with this conception or this thought, you have to say, "Well, I have this thought, I am myself the thought." When you try to think very deeply about this, you will have to say to yourself, "When I lay claim to this thought, I myself am this thought in my inmost being." But while having the idea, it would be a presupposition to talk in addition about, quote, "I am," close quote, or something similar. There is no "I am" involved in the affair while you are involved in the thought. You yourself are the thought. You would have to practice quite hard if, in addition to the thought which you are having, you also wanted to be something. In the first instance, you become immersed in the thoughts or feelings directly within you. Imagine a thought of this kind is aroused in you by this stick of chalk. If you take no notice of anything apart from the inner picture of the chalk arising out of your perception of it, then your own inner being is at one with this idea of the chalk. But if, having arrived at this idea, you then remember that you also saw a stick of chalk yesterday, then you are drawing a comparison between the immediate idea of the chalk and yesterday's experience of chalk. And if you have the precise thought of being immediately identified with today's chalk, you will become aware that you can no longer be identified with yesterday's chalk. Yesterday's stick of chalk will have to remain as a remembered idea. So if you have truly become one with the present idea of the chalk, then the chalk of yesterday will have become something external to your inner being. So today's chalk is now your true inner being. Your memory is something to which you can look back, but juxtaposed with today's idea, it is something external. This is how it is with everything you have experienced in your soul, with the exception of the present moment. The present moment is your current inner being. You are no longer encumbered with your former experiences. They are now external to your inner being. You can make a picture of this by imagining that the present moment is the snake, while everything you have already got rid of is the discarded skin of the snake. It is as though the snake discards one skin and then another and then a third, leaving them all behind. In the same way, by comparison with your present inner being, everything else has been discarded. Thus, by remembering anything, you are immediately transforming something inward into something external. The idea you have of the chalk becomes something external as soon as you move on to another idea. So you are constantly working at throwing things out and making them external. You turn your back on your inner being by immediately discarding it like a skin and making it external. This is what goes into making up the life of the soul. That which is inward continuously becomes something outward. Thus, in our own inner being, in this inner spiritual process, we are able to distinguish between what is actually internal and that external something which is within the internal. We remain within, but in this inwardness we distinguish between two parts: the part which is our own inner being, and that part of our inner being which has become external. You now see that this process we have observed running its course, this process in which something inward is transformed into something outward, is what brings into being the content of our life of soul. If you think about this, you will discover that what you can call your soul is everything you have experienced since that point in your early childhood when you began to remember. A person who forgets everything he has experienced would, in a way, have lost his I, capital. The ability to put our memories behind us and yet retain them like continuously discarded skins is what constitutes the reality of our soul life. You can think of this reality of soul life as being shaped in many different ways. Please take note of the fact that moment by moment the life of soul assumes a different shape. Think of going for a walk on a beautiful starlit night, or of listening to a Beethoven symphony. In each such moment, you identify within yourself a wide spectrum of your life of soul. If you leave that starlit night and enter a pitch-dark, miserable room, it is like a shriveling of your soul life. Or if the symphony falls silent, then your experience of listening also shrivels. And as for going to sleep, then your life of soul shrinks to nothing until it inflates once more when you wake up again. Thus is your life of soul being continuously reshaped. We can make a drawing of this, but it is only a symbol because we have to draw it in space, whereas we are trying to depict something in time. In making a drawing, we can depict multitudinous shapes. Here, A, there is a shriveling up, and here, B, there is a spreading out. We can think of it as being shaped in manifold ways, whereby here, C, we always have the content of the life of soul. This symbolic depiction, and it is merely an attempt to make visible something which is invisible, shows the inflating and deflating of the life of soul. Listening to a symphony yields a richer soul life than merely hearing one drum beating. The life of the soul, then, can be described as involving an expansion and a contraction, but not in a spatial sense. This process of expansion and contraction most certainly involves an inner spiritual movement. Movement. The life of the soul is movement. You must think of movement as such, not as something which takes place in space, but as we have described it. And this expansion and contraction yields shapes. So you have movement and an external expression of the movement in certain formations, in certain forms without, however, there being any forms in space. The forms involved are not spatial forms, but forms which expand and contract, which increase and decrease the life of the soul. And what is it that lives in this expanding and contracting? Well, you could come closer to the reality of it by thinking about what must be living there. It is your feelings, your thoughts, and your will impulses which live there, in so far as all these are spiritual. There is a resemblance with water floating, creating forms as it moves, but spiritually, of course. And now, there is only one more thing which you must imagine in order to comprehend this whole affair. We have said that thoughts live in it, ideas, feelings, and impulses of will. But the will impulses are, in a certain way, something which is even more fundamentally necessary than the thoughts. If you consider that this soul life can be caused to move sometimes more quickly, sometimes more slowly, then you will sense inwardly that it is the will which sets these things in motion. If you stimulate your will, you can cause thoughts and feelings to flow more rapidly. And if the will is sluggish, then everything runs more slowly. You need the will in order to expand the life of soul. Therefore, we have the sequence: will, then everything living in feelings and ideas, which in our soul life can be understood as wisdom. Then we have movement, the expansion and contraction. And finally, the formation, the form which appears as the expression of movement. In the life of your soul, you can distinguish quite clearly between will, wisdom, movement, and form. All this lives and weaves in the life of the soul. It is a pity that this cycle of lectures cannot be extended to last a month, for if it could, we should be able to speak in more detail. Then you would see how it is possible to verify precisely what goes on in your soul, which has, you could say, will as its root, and then also contains wisdom and movement and form. You will see how noteworthy it is that the sequence I have written down here for the life of soul conforms in a remarkable way with the names we have been able to allot to the succession of the hierarchies, from the spirits of will, of wisdom, and of movement, right up to the spirits of form. By setting forth our own soul life like this, we have, so to speak, caught hold for a fleeting moment of one aspect of the hierarchies. The hierarchies reveal themselves in a special way within our life of soul. They show how the way in which they work is completely non-spatial. And if we had learned nothing else, we have at least discovered one important thing in what we have said, a further important characteristic of these four hierarchies, the spirits of will, of wisdom, of movement, and of form, namely, that they are non-spatial. It is very important that form refers to a non-spatial formation at work in soul and spirit. So, when we speak of the forms created by the spirits of form, we do not mean externally spatial forms. We mean these inner formations of which we only become aware inwardly and which we can grasp as our life of soul runs its course. There, everything takes place solely in time. Without time, you cannot comprehend any of this. Apart from giving an explanation, which is of no significance as such, you must imagine it non-spatially when you remain within the life of soul. If the spirits of will were at work initially on old Saturn, the spirits of wisdom on old Sun, the spirits of movement on old Moon, and the spirits of form on the Earth, then our description of the latter, with regard to their purely inward nature, would have to say that on the Earth the spirits of form created the human being with a form that was as yet invisible. This tallies nicely with what we discovered yesterday. At the beginning of his earthly development, the spirits of form gave to the human being invisible, non-spatial forms. We must be aware that all the external objects we now perceive with our senses are also nothing other than an external manifestation of something spiritually inward. We must realize that behind every external, spatial, physical thing, there exists something very much resembling what lives in our own soul. We do not become aware of this through our outer senses, but it exists behind what our external senses show us. How then might we imagine a spiritual working which goes beyond what the spirits of form create non-spatially? What I mean is, if the spiritual working continues on from will, wisdom, movement, and form to something beyond form, what happens then? You see, when a process in the universe has progressed until form is achieved, still entirely in the realm of spirit and soul, not in space, when this process has reached such a supersensible form, then it is only possible for the next stage to come about if the form as such breaks into fragments. And this is indeed what we see with spiritual vision. When certain forms, having been created through the influence of the spirits of form, reach a certain stage, they are shattered. And when you look at these broken forms, which arise when supersensible forms are shattered, what you are then seeing is the transition from what is supersensible to the sense-perceptible aspect of space. That broken form is matter. When matter appears in the universe, it is, for the person with spiritual vision, nothing other than smashed, shattered, exploded form. Imagine this stick of chalk to be invisible, and to have this peculiar parallel epipedic shape. And then imagine taking a hammer and smashing it to pieces so that it bursts into myriads of tiny fragments. Well, then you have broken the form. And imagine that in the very moment of being smashed to bits, the invisible becomes visible. Then you have an image of matter coming into existence. Matter as such is spirit, which develops until it attains form, and then bursts, breaks, collapses in upon itself. Matter is a heap of rubble, of spirit rubble. It is most important to pay attention to this definition of matter being a rubble heap of spirit. Matter is in reality shattered spirit. If you then continue with this train of thought, you will say, "Very well, but we see spatial forms such as the beautiful shapes of crystals. In crystals we are confronted with very beautiful spatial forms, and yet you are telling us that all matter is a rubble heap of spirit, that it is shattered spirit." Well, to give you another idea, think of a stream of water trickling down. Assume that it is invisible, so you cannot see it. Here, B, you place an obstacle in its way, and as it splashes down, it bursts into drops, C. And imagine that the falling water is invisible, but for bursting drops, and imagine the falling water is invisible, but the bursting drops are visible. Another image of matter coming into being. But now remove the imagined obstacle, since if it did exist, it would already be matter. You must imagine that without any obstacle, the matter, while spiritually gaining form, is still spiritual, for movement always precedes form. Nothing exists which has not been permeated by the deeds of the spirits of movement. At a certain point, the movement arrives at the form, loses its energy, and collapses within itself. The main idea is to imagine that something of spirit and soul beams out, but only with a limited amount of momentum, so that as the momentum fades, it rebounds on itself and in doing so bursts. We can then say that where matter comes into existence, it is based on something supersensible which has reached the limit of its effectiveness, so that it then bursts. Before it bursts, it still has forms spiritually within it. But after the bursting, whatever spiritual form had been there continues to work on. Where the continued working is strong, the lines of the spiritual forms continue on after the bursting. And in the lines drawn by the burst pieces, as they scatter there, is an expression of an after effect. This is how crystals arise. Crystals are a subsequent creation of spiritual forms, which their momentum propels backward against the original direction. This drawing here is almost exactly what spiritual vision gives us for hydrogen. Hydrogen looks to spiritual vision like a stream rushing in from infinity, which then grows sluggish and bursts asunder. We can depict it by showing the lines overshooting and keeping their forms thus. So a particle of hydrogen looks like this. It looks like an invisible stream which arises from the infinities of space and in the end breaks asunder like a stream scattering drops. In short, matter everywhere can be termed broken spirituality. Matter is nothing other than spirit, but spirit in a state of brokenness. I must now present your souls with a difficult thought, which is connected with what I said at the beginning. I indicated that within our inner spirit and soul, we ourselves distinguish between something external and something internal. In fact, all the dimensions of space are composed of these contrasts. Thus, wherever you have a dimension in space, this spatial dimension has to be seen as having a starting point somewhere. This is the internal aspect, and everything else is external. For a surface, the straight line is internal, while everything else is external, and so on. Thus, space is nothing other than what arises when spirit has to burst and then pass over into material existence. Now, it is exceedingly important to take note of the following. Imagine spirit bursting and shattering and thus becoming matter when there is not as yet any physical matter in existence. It bursts and shatters without meeting with any kind of previously existing external resistance. Imagine it bursting, shattering into what is, so to speak, like a vacuum. When spirit bursts into emptiness, then what comes into being is mineral matter. But now, imagine spirit bursting, shattering into what is no longer a pure, virginal universe. Imagine the bursting and shattering meeting not with utter emptiness, but with an existing ether substantiality. When the spirit makes its way into emptiness, as it develops, then mineral matter is what arises. But suppose it develops toward an already existing ether substantiality. The bursting spirituality puffs its way into an ether body. Imagine this matter and this ether bodies being already in existence. Then the bursting spirituality does not enter into the virginal nothingness of the world, but into the ether body. The result is the creation not of mineral matter, but of plant matter. So when spirit bursts into ether substance, the matter of vegetation is the result. Yesterday, however, we met with a particular kind of ether substance. You remember the chart on the blackboard showing an ether body with a predominance, a preponderance over astral substance. And we said that this was the result of luciferic influences having an effect on the human being. And we found not only ether substance with a preponderance over the astral, but also a physical bodily nature with a preponderance over the ether substance of the ether body. This is what we found at first, is it not? Think now about this peculiarity, which is a result solely of the Luciferic influence. Think about this peculiar collaboration in this imperfectly assembled human organization. Where the physical body comes upon the ether body, and where the ether body is confused by the preponderance of the physical body, it is not simply the case that the spirit bursts and shatters into the ether substance. Here, it bursts into a body which is indeed an ether body, but one which is weighed down by the physical. When spirit bursts into a substance that has been prepared in this way, then the consequence is the creation of nerve substance, nerve materiality. So, here we have spirit bursting into the ether bodily nature, which is weighed down by physical bodily nature, and the result is nerve materiality. We are looking at three stages of materiality. First, the ordinary matter, which we find here in the external world. Then, the matter which is found in the bodies of plants. And then, the materiality of human and animal bodies as a result of irregularities. Imagine what it would take to enumerate all the various conditions regulating the many materials in the world. We saw a few irregularities yesterday, brought about by the influence of Lucifer. And we saw how the ether body can have a preponderance over the astral body. When spirit bursts into the substance of an astral body, which is outweighed by the ether body, then muscle material arises. This is why both nerve material and muscle material have such an unusual appearance, which cannot be compared with anything else in the external world. It is because they come into being in such a complicated way. You can see the differences when you take molten metal and splash it first into the air and then into water and then perhaps up against something solid. This shows how complicated are the ways in which the various substantialities in the world arise. What I mainly wanted to show you today is how deeply one must delve into existence if one truly desires to fathom these things. Let us go to where the I, capital, works with a preponderance over the astral body. If spirit bursts in upon what it encounters there in this bodily irregularity, which has come about through the I, it in its I-ishness outweighing the astral body, let me read that again, if spirit bursts in upon what it encounters there in this bodily irregularity, which has come about through the I, in its I-ishness outweighing the astral body, then, although in a very roundabout way, bone material comes into existence. Everything depends, as you have seen, on the way in which matter bursts asunder while being created by the spirit. Try and retain what I have been telling you, even if you cannot quite follow it all with your thoughts. You will have grasped the main content, namely, that matter must everywhere be seen as sparking, bursting spirit, which is met by something coming toward it. Depending on what it is which comes toward it, it will spark and burst into something else, leading to the creation of various configurations of matter, such as nerves, muscles, bones, and so on. A question will now be forming in your souls, and that is, what would have become of the human being if the Luciferic influence had not become involved in this relationship? Yesterday we already mentioned a number of developments. But what would have taken place in this instance? Well, nerves, such as we possess today, would not have come into being. In their material aspect, nerves only came about because of the disorder. And similarly, we would have received neither bones nor muscles if the Luciferic influence had not interfered. In short, we have seen various types of matter coming into being through the way in which forms pour themselves spiritually into something which is only there because of the luciferic influence. None of these muscle and nerve materials and so on would have arisen without the luciferic influence. We must now ask even more intensely than we did yesterday, what is the material, physical human being as a whole? As we see him externally, here on the earth, he is nothing other than the consequence of the luciferic influence. He would have neither nerves nor muscles nor bones in today's sense if the luciferic influence had not been present. What materialism describes is nothing other than what Lucifer has made of the human being. So, in rejecting anything else, materialistic thinking is, above all, the pupilship of Lucifer. So then, what would the human being be like if he had remained under the influence of paradise? To make it easier to build on these things in our minds tomorrow, I shall now sketch briefly what the human being would have become if the luciferic influence had not interfered. If this influence had not interfered, there would first of all, in human evolution on earth, have been what comes from the influence of the spirits of form. These spirits of form were the final spirits from among the higher hierarchies who worked in upon human beings. These spirits of form created form, which was purely spiritual, without initially any spatial aspect. What they created would have been invisible to outer eyes, for external senses cannot perceive forms which consist purely of soul elements. What would have come about is consistent with what, in How to Know Higher Worlds, I described as imaginative knowledge. Imagination is what the spirits of form would initially have created. There would have been nothing sense perceptible, but only purely supersensible imagination. We can look at this diagram, there's a diagram, which shows approximately what would have come about. It is an image of the imagination which the spirits of form created of the human being, and it would have been permeated with what previous hierarchies had also created in him. It would be permeated with what the spirits of movement placed in him, inner movement. See diagram 2. And it would appear to us as something which I also described in title How to Know Higher Worlds, as having been given by the knowledge arising from inspiration. For these movements would have been recognizable purely as inspiration. What I mean is that the whole human being would consist of imagination, and then the next thing would come about, which is movement, inspiration, and the spirits of wisdom would have given intuition. All this would be real inner content. Here, diagram 3, we would show intuition directly given by beings. And the whole would then be enveloped as though in an ovate aura appearing out of the cosmos, which would represent the spirits of will, see diagram 4. This would have been the supersensible nature of the human being, consisting solely of what would have been accessible to supersensible knowledge. However fanciful this may seem, it is the real human being shown, if I may put it like this, symbolically. The human being of paradise, who does not consist of matter as he does today, but who has a truly supersensible nature. What then became of the luciferic influence? Well, the luciferic influence caused the imaginations to spray out through the bursting spirit. They sprayed into matter, which became what we have today as our skeletal system. The skeletal system is the human being of imagination filled in with matter. Matter is no part of the higher human being. It catapulted into what would have remained entirely with imagination if the luciferic influence had not arrived. One would have been able to walk straight through a human being, which now sounds nonsensical, if these imaginations had not first been drawn together and then additionally stuffed with bony matter. Now, one would bump into the bones if one were to walk through the human being. He has become impermeable. What came from the spirits of movement is filled out with muscular matter, and what would be perceptible as intuition is filled out with nerve matter. And only now, in what goes beyond this, do we come to something supersensible, namely the human ether body, which, although it is spiritual, does still contain the most tenuous matter, more tenuous even than nerve matter, and which is not in any way taken into consideration. So, you can see that the human being has become an exceedingly coarse creature. If he had become what the gods originally intended, he would have had no bones, and the supersensible bones of imagination would have given him his form. He would have no muscles as instruments of movement. Supersensible substance would have moved within him, whereas now what moves is everywhere spiked with muscular substance. That which the spirits of movement gave as supersensible movement has been transformed into the physical movement of the muscles. And that which the spirits of wisdom gave by way of intuition has become in the sense-perceptible human being the nerve material spiked into the intuition. And regarding the skeletal system depicted today in anatomy textbooks, we can say this was originally intended to be a pure imagination, but through the luciferic and the Ahrimanic influence, it has been so coarsened that we are now faced with these dense, thick, brittle, hard bones. So solidified have the imaginations become. Still, surely one can hardly say that no splendid reflection of imagination can be found in the physical world. Those who know that this skeletal human being is an image of imagination will certainly see the picture of the human skeleton as an image from the world of imagination. And when you see a picture of the human muscular system, you should really say to yourselves, this is entirely unnatural. Inwardly, it is a lie, because I see it pictured instead of hearing it in spirit. This is because, actually, you are looking at supersensible, rhythmical movement spiked with muscular matter, which should be removed. What remained would be invisible. It would be audible, in the same way as the flowing instruments of music are audible. Inspirations should really be audible. But what you see pictured as the muscular human being represents inspirations spiked with matter. And as for the human being of nerves, you should neither see nor hear him, but perceive him purely spiritually. For a cosmic view of the world, such depictions are entirely out of place, since what ought to be comprehended in pure spirituality is a spiritual wrapping spiked with physical matter, so that we are shown a visible depiction of what ought to be perceived solely as an intuition. This departure from paradise shows that the human being was indeed originally in the spiritual world, in paradise, where he consisted of imagination, inspiration, and intuition. In other words, he was in an entirely unearthly existence. But then, through what he himself provoked, through the luciferic influence, he became as though spiked with matter through what burst forth out of the spirit. This is what fills us, but does not really belong to us. We bear this matter within us, and because we carry it in us, we have to die physically. This is indeed the reason for physical death, and for much else also. Having, as it were, departed from his spiritual state, the human being is able to live here in physical existence only until matter overcomes what holds it together. The fact is that matter constantly wants to burst open, and the matter in the bones is only held together by the strength of imagination. Once the strength of the bones gains the upper hand, they are no longer capable of life. It is the same with the muscles and nerves. When the matter in bones, muscles, and nerves gains the upper hand, over imagination, inspiration, and intuition, and can thus burst forth, then the human being has to lay aside his physical body. Herein, then, lies the connection between physical death and the Luciferic influence. Tomorrow, we shall investigate how evil and such like, illnesses and so on, came into the world. The end of Lecture 4.